It's one-on-one. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're here for another interesting coffee house conversation. And my guest today is Roman Dial. He's a professor at Alaska Pacific University of Biology and Mathematics. Sounds pretty daunting, but I invited him here today more because of the amazing adventures that he's done over the years. He is truly the guy that you would trust in the outdoors. Used to do these incredible races where people would get together and they'd race from one point in Alaska to another, just working their way through the wilderness. And he's done a lot of other amazing stuff over the years. And I'm really glad to have the opportunity to sit down and talk about some of your adventures and just the extraordinary stuff you've done in Alaska. It seems like you've been from one corner to the other.
Well, I've tried to, but my wife and family don't let me go to all of them.
Yeah, there's right to be some left. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're 14 years old, and you are from the suburbs of Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And you land in Alaska, and it sounds like you're just footloose and fancy free. I mean, tell me what that summer was like and what you sort of discovered.
Well, when I was 14, I came up to visit my uncles who were working on the pipeline. And I had one here in Anchorage, and I had another one in Delta Junction. And, you know, ostensibly I was supposed to hang out with my uncles, but mostly I traveled around hitchhiking between the two and then backpacking where I could, like down on the Kenai and in the Alaska Range, and sort of getting into trouble generally. But it was really an exciting time.
So you're basically on your own, just with your thumb and working your way around the highways? And like,
I was, yeah.
Say, oh, that looks like an interesting mountain, I think I'll climb it?
I tried that sort of thing. Yeah, I did. I tried to get up on the Harding Ice Field, and I got some maps of the Harding Ice Field. This was before they had the road out to the Exit Glacier. So I walked up along the Resurrection River and tried to get up and couldn't get onto the ice field, and then came down and tried to cross the river and got swept away and managed to swim out of it and get back to the road. But that was a real sort of spooky.
So you didn't particularly know what you were doing.
I didn't know what I was doing. In fact, I probably could have very well ended up like Chris McCandless, who died up by Healy.
Except it didn't sound like you were depressed. You were like more out having fun.
Well, I wasn't. I definitely wasn't depressed. I mean, I was a little unhappy when I came out of the river, but but no, I was just trying to. Coming from the suburbs of D.C., Alaska was much more exciting.
So, I mean, the question that's crossing everybody's mind right now is, like, what were your parents thinking?
Right, what were my parents thinking? I think they didn't really know. I didn't really tell my parents what happened till I was probably in my 20s.
But you kind of got a bug at that point, right?
Well, actually, I got the bug when I was even younger, when I was 9. And I came up to visit the same uncles in Usabelli. And in Usabelli, they were working in the coal mines there, and I was 9, and I had a motorcycle, and they had a wolf dog for me to play with, and I had a .22, and I would just wander around.
And you just
the
took
Alaska
off in the wilderness like a wild.
I did,
wild
yeah,
child.
Yeah, wow. I did, and I would. I had a taxidermy course that I got in the mail. It was a packet of books, and so I entertained myself, and that's what hooked me.
So you were like shooting things and then stuffing them, basically.
Yep, I did that when I was 9, and it was. All that freedom that I had and that excitement, that's when the Alaska bug bit me. And so from 9 until I was old enough to leave home, I just wanted to get to Alaska any way I could. And then once I left home, I moved here, and I've been here pretty much ever since.
So you graduated from high school at a young age.
Yeah.
You must have been pretty gifted.
Well, I didn't really like school, so I tried to finish a year early. And
so you got out of there at 16 and sort of deciding where college to go to, and easy choice?
Yeah, I went to UAF. I went to Fairbanks and studied math and biology there.
And it sounds like that's when you really got into some of the more gnarly mountain climbing and becoming a little bit more expert at it.
Well, that's where I ran into people who were real adventurers, and they sort of took me under their wing and taught me how to climb and how to boat and how to ski and do all that sort of adventure.
So, what is the attraction of putting yourself out on the edge and going to some place that's really wild? Because, I mean, we're not talking about going doing the Resurrection Pass trail on the weekend or boating on Big Lake. I mean, we're talking about, like, finding the wildest place and just throwing yourself in the middle of it.
Well, I think one of the major appeals to me about that is we're sort of surrounded by a world that's so dominated by people that to sort of get away from people. I like people. You know, I'm married. I have 2 kids. I have friends. You know, I teach college students. I like people, but I feel kind of like humans just dominate the world so much that it's refreshing to find a place where they don't dominate.
Yeah.
You know, like when you fly over the lower 48 and you look out the window. I mean, I don't even take window seats anymore. It's just too depressing to look out the window. And all you see is humanity, maybe a little postage-sized stamp of forest someplace. Whereas in Alaska, as you know, when you fly across Alaska, you don't, you want to be at the window because you look out and there's this landscape that's uninhabited. Maybe there's a little island of people down there. So so because I think because it's so rare that I like to visit those places and seek them out.
Well, a lot of us do, but you've actually walked from Kivalina on the Bering Sea coast to the Pipeline Haul Road, which is sort of the eastern interior Alaska. I mean, just and you just walked it, right? I mean, what were you getting at when you did that?
Well, that was a long 600-mile walk. We did that. Jason Geck, also from APU, and I did that about 6 years ago. And 20 years ago, when I was a math student, I tried to predict how far I could walk carrying all my own food, because as you carry your food, your pack is heavy, but it gets lighter each day, so you speed up. So I was thinking, how far could I actually go? How much food could I carry, and how far could I go? So I built a little mathematical model. It took 20 years before I found other people who were interested in trying to test the model. And so...
So you're excluding gathering any food on the way.
Right, we didn't gather any food, and we didn't leave any caches, and we didn't use any pack rafts or skis or bikes or anything, no sleds, just carrying everything. And then we looked around to find a place where we could do that sort of a trip. And Jason Geck, who's also an instructor at APU, he is a GIS instructor, so we used computerized maps to pinpoint the area in Alaska that was farthest from any roads or villages.
Oh, so you like mathematically make sure that you're going to the most remote place you could possibly go.
Exactly. So we walked there and, you know, held up the GPS and took pictures of ourselves. You know, like, this is it. And then we
walked. Did it look like, about like every other place?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it was tussocks, you know, and mosquitoes. And then we continued walking to Anaktuvik Pass, and then we didn't pick up. Well, actually there, we did violate the rules. He had to fly out there. He wanted to go back and see his fiancée, whom he missed quite a bit. And so at Anaktuvik Pass, he says, well, I'm going to fly out and I'm going to stop and you know, have a cheeseburger and stay in a hotel. And he goes, you can sleep under the bridge and eat cream of wheat if you want. But so I violated my own rule. You know, I went and I ate with him at the restaurant and slept in a bed.
Do you regret it?
Not at all. I mean, I would have felt silly not doing that, you know? And because it was, you know, it was, I still had food left. And I walked to the road the next 2 days. So I ended up doing the whole distance, and I don't really feel like
food
it was
left
cheating.
Over, huh?
I did have food left over, So I didn't really feel like I was cheating, and and whose rules were they? You know, who, what was I trying to prove and to whom? It was all for me.
But there is like a competitive element in what you're doing, isn't there? Because I remember these races that you used to be involved in, where essentially some people would get together and they'd choose 2 points and like far, far apart in Alaska, and they'd say, okay, go, and like the way the best man get there first, right? And it was like truly, potentially life-threatening, challenging terrain, totally without trails you're going across. I mean, it's an orienteering like to the
right. It was like on orienteering on steroids. Yeah, you know, it was all swollen up. Yeah, well, absolutely. That
I mean, there must be a competitive element in there that makes it fun.
Right. Oh, I'm definitely competitive. I'm not as competitive as I was when I was younger, for sure. But yeah, I'm definitely competitive. My daughter's competitive. You know, she seems to inherited that from me.
What was the craziest race you ever did?
Well, the craziest race I ever did. Well, I think the craziest, I'm not sure. I would say the craziest race I ever did was Nebezpina McCarthy around and across the Wrangles. But it wasn't me who did the crazy stunt. It was Chuck Comstock who did the crazy stunt. And Chuck Comstock, he, instead of walking around the Wrangles through Scolai Pass, like the rest of us did, and rafting down Chittistone River, Chuck took cross-country racing skis and went up over the Nebezpina Glacier to the top of the Stairway Icefall above McCarthy, and he had a parapent, like a kite that, you know, was hooked like a parachute. And he jumped off the Stairway Icefall and flew down and had to land and stop and spend the night because the weather was bad. And then the next day he had to jump off this ice cliff halfway down the icefall and fly again, and he got stuck in the weather and had to camp again. He spent 3 nights, one at the top, one midway, one like a quarter of the way, and finally landed on the bottom, and he came to the finish dead last.
After all that.
After all that. But if you go to McCarthy today...
That's legendary, though.
It's legendary. Nobody remembers who won the race, but they all remember Chuck Comstock.
Right, the racing concept is you're on your own, and it's whatever you can carry, right? So you're using pack rafts, and like he was using a parachute type
deal, right? Exactly.
So a lot of people don't know anything about pack rafts. I know you've written a book about them. Tell us, like, what's a pack raft and how you go about using one?
Well, pack raft, you can see it's sort of like pack rafting by Roman Dial. You can buy it here in town. It's an inflatable boat. It weighs about 4 pounds, and you can carry it, and then you can blow it up. We usually use these little inflation bags that weigh a few ounces, and you blow it up, and then you can get in it. And in the beginning, we just crossed rivers in the early races. That's where I first saw one.
Because there's no way you could get over a major river without...
Without
drowning.
Swimming, yeah. And the swimming is miserable. And in one of these races, you know, you'd have a backpack and just rain gear because you're going as light as you can, and swimming was dangerous. And so I learned from this guy, he was 55 at the time, which seemed old. He pulled this raft out of his pack during one of these races and paddled across. And, you know, light bulbs went off over our heads, and we thought, well, we want to do that. And so we all had rafts the next year, and then we continued to use these rafts. And about 10 years ago, a woman started, she made a raft for her son, and she made a really good, high-quality raft, and now she's gone into this business that makes really super good pack rafts. And so that's become a real sort of passion of mine, is whitewater pack rafting. But in the early days, we just used these pack rafts to kind of, in these races, to cross rivers, and then we realized we could float the rivers, and then I realized, wow, I can do trips in Alaska where we hike, and then raft, and then hike, and then raft, so my wife and I...
You can go anywhere.
Go anywhere.
Yeah. Yep. Now, whitewater pack rafting sounds like an adrenaline kind of thing. Are you kind of an adrenaline junkie and wanting to get out there and do things just because they're dangerous?
Well, I don't know if they're just because they're dangerous. I'm not so sure I like the danger aspect, but I don't mind feeling afraid. You know, I guess, and it doesn't have to be dangerous to feel afraid. Like, you can go to an amusement park and get on a roller coaster, and when you know, you're up at the top, and then the bottom drops out from under you, and you roll down, you feel afraid, but it's not dangerous.
Right.
And so I guess a lot of the pack rafting I do, I don't think it's dangerous, but I do find that it's exhilarating and thrilling. And I do, just like there's a competitive side to me, there might be a bit of a thrill junkie side, too. Yeah.
Well, what about just the misery aspect? I mean, because if you are hiking for, I mean, I've done just enough of this to know that if you're hiking across the Arctic, you know, over muskeg, I guess you'd call it muskeg or tussocks, or black spruce forest that's full of mosquitoes, you're not having any fun.
Right.
Right? I mean, you're carrying a heavy pack and you're sweating probably like crazy.
Yeah.
Do you just have a higher tolerance for that than other people, or do you somehow find pleasure in just, you know, the kind of drudgery of that you can sometimes encounter?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I do like bushwhacking, for example. Mm-hmm. And what I like about bushwhacking is when it's really bad bushwhacking, I like finding a good way through. I like finding animal trails. Mm-hmm. When things are really difficult, I do find a certain amount of pleasure out of making it less difficult or less suffering. I feel there's a reward in that. So like in this, you know, like maybe it's, you know, it's like a valley of misery. I really like in the valley of misery finding these small ridges and peaks of pleasure and being able to stay on those, kind of figuratively, if you will.
Sure.
And that's very rewarding to me. And I especially like things that are improbable, where like going from here to there looks improbable, but you find a way that goes, and that's extremely satisfying to me, kind of like a puzzle.
Yeah.
Physical puzzle.
Well, this is a really fascinating conversation. I'm talking with Professor Roman Dial today. He's a professor at Alaska Pacific University, biology and mathematics. We're going to talk about that a little bit in the second half. I've been having too much fun learning about his outdoor adventures in the first half. My name is Charles Wolforth. The show is One-on-One. But I have to make sure that we touch on Playboy bunnies.
Well, I hope my wife's not watching.
Or Playboy, what are they called? Story. Playboy models or something?
I think they're bunnies.
Okay.
Yep, they're bunnies.
And you somehow got involved in doing an expedition with a group of Playboy bunnies? What was that all about?
Well, what happened is, you know, we did these wilderness races. Mm-hmm. You know, we started with the Hope to Homer in the early 80s and went all around the state up through the 90s and the 2000s. And that was sort of an Alaskan adventure race, we called it, mm-hmm. wilderness race. And mm-hmm. then somehow the rest of the world invented adventure racing. Mm-hmm. And I got invited to do a couple adventure races, and our teams did well. And I was on one kind of a quasi-professional team. I would make some money.
So like in some other part of the world? Where
Yeah, I did one like in British Columbia. I did one in Australia. I did one in Patagonia. Mm-hmm. Did one in Ecuador. And I was going to go do one in Fiji with this team that was like a professional team. We got money. We were highly sponsored. Because these were expensive races. You know, there'd be four people. You had to have a man and a woman, and you had to have all this equipment and fly across to another continent and go horseback riding and mountain biking and sea kayaking and trekking and whitewater rafting.
Well, who gives you money to do that?
Well, Earthlink in the old days, Yahoo gave us money, high-tech shoes gave us some money.
So it's an advertising thing for them.
Advertising, yeah. And so I was on a team and I got kicked off 3 weeks before the race and because I wouldn't go to California to train with them, ostensibly. And so I was without a team and I got a phone call from this woman, you know, I'll call her Miss April. And Miss April called me and said, hey, you know, I'm putting this Playboy Extreme team together to go do the Eco Challenge in Fiji, and we need a navigator. And a navigator is the person who, you know, finds the improbable route through the Valley of Misery. Mm-hmm. And that was my usual role on these adventure race teams. There was a team, and I would be the one who found how we would go.
I see.
And so they needed a navigator, and it was going to be these three Playboy bunnies, you know, women who'd been in the Playboy centerfolds, and they needed one man, and they needed him to be their navigator. And they asked if I would do it. I'm like, yeah, you know, I told my wife, and she's like, oh no, you can't go. And I said, but they'll pay me. And she goes, oh well, they've got to pay you like X. And X was like, she'll even admit she picked X to be so high that she was sure
never get it.
Yeah. Never, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I told Miss April, yeah, well, I can do it, but you know, you're gonna have to pay me. She's like, well, how much? I said, you know, X. She's like, oh, yeah, that's a lot of money. I don't know. I haven't got the sponsorship yet. But she did get the sponsorship, and then she called me back and she said, well, how about, you know, X minus Y? I'm like, sure. Yeah. And my wife was like, no, it's X. Uh-huh. And so I had to call back and say, yeah, sorry, got to be the original amount. And she says, okay. Wow. So I went down there.
You're covered.
I made a bunch of money and we did the race.
Uh-huh. Now tell me, are these women really physically fit and outdoorsy enough to do something like that without it being, were you dragging them along?
Well, I did carry a lot of their equipment, and there were three of them. So, one of them, Miss April, the captain of the mm-hmm. team, the one who found the money, she was really super smart, super savvy, really strong and capable mm-hmm. and athletic. And then there was another
relatively
one.
Relatively attractive, I suppose.
Yeah, we'd all find them attractive, yeah. Uh-huh. And then there was a small one, and she was petite and really nimble on her feet, and she couldn't carry, she wasn't really she couldn't carry a lot of weight, but she could keep up and mm-hmm. dance across these rocks. And then there was another one, and she was not quite as athletic as the mm-hmm. other two. And she couldn't even really ride a bicycle. And she was blonde, and and she didn't know as much as the other uh-huh. two either. And so, I thought I would really have to take care of them, and I did, and I mm-hmm. thought we wouldn't be able to finish, and we didn't finish. Wow. But we probably would have if the captain of the team hadn't gotten sick. She got sick, she got some sort of infection that went systemic, and we actually had to, you know, call in a rescue for her.
Yeah, really.
She was delirious and had a fever, and so I was actually very impressed. I'd never been in the back of a race before. I'd mm-hmm. always been in the front, and I'd always sort of disdain the people in the back. And once I was back there, I realized that they actually got a lot more out of these adventure races than the people in the front. The people in the front do them all the time. They kind of know what they're getting into. Up there, it's all about the competition. But the people in the back were having these real experiences that were once in a lifetime for them. Mm-hmm. And they were having very very strong emotions, if you will, with the natural environment that they'd never experienced before. Yeah. So that was really neat to see. And I was really impressed by how well these girls
and
did.
And maybe it didn't have the same, I mean, you, there's a lot about this, it's psychological, right? The fact that you know you can do it, you've done it before, you're into it. Whereas if you're doing it for the first time, you might be scared. You know, you have to overcome more that way.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like they didn't, you know, crossing rivers, camping in the dark, you know, sleeping without sleeping bags, all of that was new for them.
Yeah.
And so I was impressed. And in the end, you know, we didn't finish, but we did well. We dropped out. We were the last of the celebrity teams to drop out,
that's good.
If you will. So that was, you know, a consolation. But yeah, it was a good experience. Yeah.
So now the more serious side of your life is as a professor, you've worked combining mathematics and biology. So for example, in the ecology where there's a lot of mathematical modeling and figuring out how organisms connect in the ecosystem. Has there been any interconnection between that work as a professor and your outdoors experience and what you're able to do outdoors?
Yeah, I'd say there has been, especially in a couple ways. Currently, I work on ice worms and we do studies on ice worms, which require us to visit glaciers and walk around on ice fields and that sort of thing, which involves some of my outdoor skills. But then for my PhD and following my PhD for about, 10 years, I did a lot of tree canopy research where we have to gain access into tall trees and then go up there, and move around and collect data and do experiments. And so it required me to use all my rope handling skills, collect data, analyze the data, sort of interpret the data within a theoretical context. And then on top of that, once you're up there, you know, the wind is blowing the trees around and there's a lot of exposure and space, and you have to sort of deal with that fear. It's an intrinsic fear that we all have, fear of high places, while collecting data. So I found that really stimulating.
Uh-huh. And where was that? Costa Rica, did you say? Or?
I've done it all around the world. I've done I've done it in the Caribbean. I've been in Costa Rica, Australia, Borneo, Washington, here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've climbed trees in Patagonia and collected data all over, actually.
So when you say ice worms, you're talking about those little organisms that actually live inside glaciers, right?
Yep. Have you seen some of those?
I have, but I mean, it's. I think a lot of people think they're mythological. I mean, they're real.
Right, thanks to Robert Service. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the real ice worm, you know, in Service's poem, you know, they're like this long, right. And they're a noodle in a bottle of alcohol. But in real life, ice worms are about an inch at the biggest. They're bigger down in Washington and Oregon and British Columbia than they are up here. And they range pretty much from Oregon all the way to the Kenai Peninsula. And we're trying to determine, you know, what limits their distribution, because you don't find them in the Alaska range. Hmm. You only find them on the coastal ranges. So I have a graduate student right now, Melissa Becker, who's determining, you know, where they're found and why. Mm-hmm. And my son recently co-authored a paper with me on the evolution and genetics of ice worms across their range, where we determine that there's probably three species, if you will, of ice worms. There's one from British Columbia and Washington, one from around Glacier Bay, and then the Chugach ice worms that are.
Well, how do they survive? You'd think that ice would be not a set where an organism could live, but is it sort of the brine or something, or how does the animal live?
Well, the way that they live is they actually, if you warm them up too much, they'll die.
Hmm.
And if you freeze them, like if you throw them in your freezer, if they get below about 20 degrees Fahrenheit, that'll kill them. So they live in a very narrow band, and they have a certain biochemistry that allows them to actually be more active as the temperature drops from, let's say, a little above freezing towards freezing. They generate more ATP, actually, in order to carry on their life processes than other organisms. But it is still sort of a mystery exactly how they do this.
Now, as we finish up here, you mentioned that you feel like you're slowing down, and your ability to do some of these extraordinary adventures is maybe going away. Is that just your body's letting you down a little bit? And how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you've invited me here to talk because you heard of some of the things I've done. So in some ways, it's a bit of an identity crisis. Like, yeah. Right, once you can't do the things that you kind of see yourself as defining you, you know, how does that make you feel? Like, if I was a writer and I couldn't write anymore, that'd be a terrible thing. Yeah. Or if I was a mathematician and I couldn't solve my equations, well, I'd be a terrible thing. And so I do sort of struggle with that, but I'm also okay with it. You know, as I get older, my competitive drive is slowing down. Not that I'm trying to prove myself to anybody, but I feel like I've had a full life and I've done a lot of things.
Well, and it's not like you're about to die or anything.
No, but I do, like, you kind of get used to doing a certain level of things, and if you don't do that level, it doesn't feel as satisfying. Like, you know, how many skiers do you know, people who were competitive ski racers in college, and then maybe they went to the Olympics or tried to ski in the Olympics, and once they're not at that level anymore, they don't even ski.
They need a new identity, Well, this has really, really been great, and Roman Dial's been my guest. Thanks so much for being with
Charles.
Us. This is his book. It's called Pack Rafting, An Introduction and How-To Guide by Roman Dial from Backpacking Light. Is that the name of the publisher?
Yep.
All right. And this has been One-on-One. Join us again next week. It's a series of coffeehouse conversations. We'll just have an interesting person each week. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with us.
One-on-One is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated. John LaFournaise directs and edits the show. Pat Yak is the producer. Camera operators are Travis Gilmore and Josh Edge. Audio engineers are Dave Waldron and Kristen Spack. One-on-One is recorded at Kaladi Brothers Cafe at JL Tower. You can watch One-on-One Sunday nights at 6:30 p.m. and Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. on KAKM Channel 7 TV, or listen Thursdays at 1 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage. Tune in next week for One-on-One when Charles Wolforth interviews puppet master Buzz Schwall. This is KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.